the way to conceive of what happened is that by 1970, they had teleportation-based time travel in the sense that they could adjust the teleporter so you would arrive a few months or years in the past or future. But they knew they couldn't push it before then because at least teleportation had to exist, right? The devices had to be there in New Mexico to get us home. But then through 70, 71, 72, they were clearly moving around within an ambit of several years. Because, for example, we made that jump from fall of 71 to the beginning of the summer of 73 in New Mexico and stayed in White Rock, New Mexico. That was the house at 20 Grand Canyon that I took Governor Ventura to on conspiracy theory. And I tried to explain that to the woman living there that I had lived there first in 1973 and then in 1972. And that was a true story because we had been quantum displaced from 71 to 73 and then in real time had teleported and stayed there in summer of 72. And there were all kinds of weird madcap kind of disconnects with Connie Chavez, because when we met with her, we would remember things that had happened and that we'd discussed with her in 73 that from her perspective in 72 hadn't happened yet. So there were some interesting sociological experiments going on. I was very upset when my dad told me we were going to spend the whole summer there. And I had actually spent several summers earlier than that, but they were sort of in a period of my childhood where they had kind of faded from memory. So there in summer of 73, as accessed from fall of 71 when I was 10, I became quite upset about the fact that we're going to be spending the whole summer there. And I was worried that primarily that my mother and four older siblings would miss me and wonder what had happened to me, like had I run away from home or something. Because I really started thinking about the significance of these hidden summers in New Mexico. And my dad showed me that at the end of the summer, we were going to loop back so as not only to teleport back to New Jersey, but back in time. So he created kind of a timeline, and they made this grand sort of fishhook-shaped drawing. So see, son, we're not just going to be teleporting back to New Jersey, but so as to arrive, you know, shortly after we originally left. So your mom and your four siblings are not going to worry about what happened to you. We're just going to be coming home from the hardware store. They're not going to know that we were in New Mexico for a whole summer.
You're listening to Exopolitics Today with Dr. Michael Sala, your source for the uncensored truth regarding the human, extraterrestrial, global, and political agenda. Click the like button and subscribe to this channel. And now, here's Dr. Michael Sala.
Well, it's my great pleasure to welcome Andy Bashagu to Exopolitics Today. And I've known Andy since 2006. We met at James Gilliland's conference up there in Mount Adams and always been fascinated by his story. And this is the first time we've actually got to do an interview together. So welcome, Andy, to the show.
Thank you for having me, Michael. Good to be with you again. I think the last time we were together was perhaps, what was it, March of 2017 at Joan Ocean's conference in Hawaii?
That's right, something like that. And that was...
about 5 years ago, yeah.
So it's really great that we get to kind of dive into your story. And there's a lot of people in my audience that probably haven't heard of you and haven't heard of how you got involved in this incredible time travel experiment called Project Pegasus. And for you, it began as a six-year-old, where you say that you were introduced to the program by your father. So why don't you tell us about your father, you know, what he did, the company he worked for, and how you got involved in Project Pegasus?
Well, this is really the origin of the U.S. time-space program that became Project Pegasus. My father was a World War II veteran. He had been a combat medic and ambulance driver with the 13th Airborne Division in France and Germany during the war. After the war, he attended Lehigh University, where he received a BS in electrical engineering. And he was working at Okanite Company in Paramus, New Jersey in 1951-52. And after the very significant overflight of our nation's capital, literally the Capitol Dome, by 9 extraterrestrial craft flying at 7,000 miles per hour as clocked by Langley Air Force Base, my father was visited by a colonel with the Air Force who came to his desk at Okanite and ordered him to report the next Monday at Curtis Wright Aeronautical Company in Wood Ridge, New Jersey. And there, my dad designed the metal alloy by which the ramjet would be built so that it wouldn't melt from molecules of air or particles of space dust in our atmosphere and when it was going out of our atmosphere to chase the extraterrestrial craft away from our planet. So that was really the time in his life in which my dad was brought into the Defense Department response to the ET situation. He was 28 years old and really just starting his career in engineering. Now, after those 3 years at Curtis Wright designing the ramjet, which was this space plane that would travel at potentially supersonic speeds to chase the ET craft away from our planet, from 1956 to 64, my dad worked at the Thomas A. Edison Research Labs in West Orange, New Jersey. There, he repeated Nikola Tesla's experiments in teleportation, because one of the things they had noticed about the craft over Washington, D.C. in July of 1952 was that they were just moving around the sky. They were basically blinking out in one location, then appearing in another, and they realized they were teleporting. So in response to the ET presence, they wanted to achieve the same technological feat. So my dad repeated Tesla's experiments at the Edison Labs, which was kind of a think tank. It wasn't the original Thomas Edison Labs. It was actually right next door to it. It was kind of a high-end think tank that had been begun by a man named Neil Williams in 1951. So there my dad essentially repeated Tesla's experiments. And then when one of Tesla's devices was set up at Curtis Wright, where he had worked on the ramjet, one of the technicians walked through the field of radiant energy that the device was propagating, and he tumbled to Africa. So that was sort of a discovery of that particular device that Tesla called an energetic array was actually a teleporter. Now, I don't know exactly when Pegasus began. I think based on the fact that Madeleine Engel's book, A Wrinkle in Time, was described by my late father as a form of disinformation. In many ways, there are certain elements in that book that were actually used to conceal the time-space program that was emerging. So I'm dating it at around 1962. But anyway, in 1967, 68, when I was 6 years old, my dad took me up to Curtis Wright. And there in Building 68, there was this elliptical-shaped boom, or armature, they called it. It was like two huge elephant tusks on the floor, maybe about 8 feet high and 10 feet apart and sort of complementary on the concave dimension, sort of just like elephant tusks would be. But they were gray booms, and they were clearly technical devices. And when you stood back by, let's say, 10 feet, the radiant energy between the two booms looks sort of like water falling in a water sculpture, sort of just a gentle cascading of a wave of light going down to the ground. But when you walked up to that field of radiant energy, it looked like raster on an old black and white TV set with little squiggles of blue and green light going across that field of energy in opposite directions at 3-inch intervals. And my dad explained that on the count of three, we were going to jump through that field of energy and we would enter a tunnel of light and we would pop out a few seconds later somewhere else on a kind of a hillside, he said, somewhere else in the country. So we experimented a couple of times. Then he had the technician turn on the device and he grabbed my hand and we leapt through that field of energy. And what happened next is we entered sort of a what's called a vortal tunnel in time-space. It had sort of a holographic character to it. It was sort of a holographic tunnel of bluish-white light. Now, if you kept your head straight, it looked like you were going forward. But if you looked down, you felt like you were going down. So it was a very odd sensation. And our hair was kind of moving around from the electrostatic discharge inside the tunnel. And just as my father had described, well, first he had warned me that he might have been separated from me in the tunnel, which is in fact what happened. He got sort of sucked through the wall of the tunnel because the tunnel would fragment as it reached its destination sometimes. So we landed at what I later realized was the state capitol grounds in Santa Fe, New Mexico, a distance that I would later research as 2,005 miles from Wood Ridge, New Jersey. And my dad and I couldn't find each other. We had popped into view in different locations there in Santa Fe. He had said to me back in New Jersey, when you arrive there, just stay there. Don't walk around because I'm going to have to find you. And it's a fairly large place there. It's a fairly large grounds that we're going to be going to. So that happened. He took about a half hour to find me. We then took a car over to the, from Santa Fe, a state kind of vehicle, a New Mexico state vehicle, over to the Los Alamos National Labs into a meeting with Dr. Harold M. Agnew. Agnew was then the director of the W division or the weapons division of LANL, the Los Alamos National Labs. Now, Agnew is really the father of time travel, not Einstein, not von Neumann, not even Tesla. It was really Harold Agnew. Harold had been the sort of the quintessential Manhattan Project physicist. He had been one of the graduate students in physics, manipulating the graphite rods when Enrico Fermi was testing CP1 or critical pile 1 at the University of Chicago. You know, the famous story of the squash courts there, preparing to build the bomb. He was in Los Alamos and Alamogordo when the bomb was designed, manufactured, and tested in the so-called, Trinity blast. He took the nuclear trigger that was placed aboard the bomb that was dropped on Hiroshima from Los Alamos to the island of Tinian, and then he followed the Enola Gay in a chase plane called the Great Artiste and actually calibrated the magnitude of the Hiroshima explosion. And so at that time, he was in the weapons division and was on his way to becoming the director of Los Alamos Labs in 1970, a position that he held until like 1978-79. So Harold's, you know, said to my dad when we got to his office, "How was your trip?" And my father said to Dr. Agnew, "Fine, Harold, and fast." And he kind of looked up somewhat sheepishly at us and said, "Oh, did you take the teleporter?" And my dad said, "Yep." And then he turned to me and said, "And so did my number three son, Andrew." And then Dr. Agnew looked over at me and said, "How old?" And my dad and I said in response at the same time, "Six." So we know that that is a significant event in the history of time-space exploration because I was born in September of 1961. So that meeting with Agnew had to take place between what? September of 1967 and September of 1968. So teleportation was fully operational by that time, 1967-68. And I'm virtually certain that it had been done for years before that, at least let's say about five. So my dad then said to Harold, "Have you tried it yet?" And he said, "No, but I want to." So it was really with that first trip to consult with Dr. Agnew that I sort of leapt in to the emerging time-space program that was then becoming fully operational in the defense technical community.
So that is fascinating that the teleportation technology was actually fully functional as early as 1967, where people could safely travel from point A to point B instantaneously. Now, you mentioned some of the Tesla technology. So what do you know of Nikola Tesla's work? I mean, the Philadelphia experiment is probably one of the most famous incidents. But that is one case where teleportation didn't occur successfully. But somehow between that right. experiment in 43 to what you went through in 1967, they had worked out the kinks. So do you know how and when that happened?
Well, I know that three individuals on the program, my father, Raymond F. Bishago, Carl Jack Pruitt, who was a team leader on Project Pegasus, who would become the research director of Project Montauk in the early 1980s. And Dr. Robert W. Beckwith, a very distinguished physicist and inventor who was also part of Project Pegasus, would always be singing the praises of the fact that the program owed the greatest debt of gratitude to Nikola Tesla. So, you know, I speak of this as the third Tesla. There was the Tesla, the electrical engineer. There was the Tesla spoken of in the sort of the renewable energy discussions of the 1970s and 80s. And then there was the third Tesla who had actually essentially engineered the technology of the future, basically things like time travel, like both teleportation in real time and then ultimately teleportation so that as to arrive in a past and future event. So clearly Pegasus, the greatest technical input to Pegasus was without question, you know, to Tesla. Primarily, that was the so-called Tesseract or Tesla Energetic Array. There was even a version of that device in a DARPA shop manual that my father showed me. He used to keep it on our hot water heater in our basement in Morris Plains, New Jersey. So there was clearly a Tesla input in the teleportation component of the program, which was one of the two major technical activities of the project, the others being the chronovisor initially of Arnetti and Gemelli, and then passed on to Bell Labs and developed into something more elaborate. But what I know about the Philadelphia experiment owes really to the constant discussion of Tesla that Dr. Beckwith would engage in when we were having, let's say, lunch or dinner in Old Town Albuquerque or in Santa Fe or in Los Alamos. What he would talk about was the fact that the Philadelphia experiment did not involve the Eldridge in Philadelphia Naval Shipyard. It involved a ship called the Martha's Vineyard in Long Island Sound. The experiment was not to achieve radar invisibility. That was part of the cover story. It was to achieve Tesla teleportation. And because the ship was made of metal, there was a huge electrostatic discharge when they tried it. They were trying to basically move the Martha's Vineyard on the surface of the ocean, initially to escape Nazi mines that had been chained to the bottom of the sea. And there weren't a multitude of sailors fused in the hull of the ship when it was brought back. There was just one sailor who had been impaled on the one of the columns of the splash cowling of the captain's mast of the ship. And individuals like Albert Einstein and John von Neumann were not in the Eldridge. The Martha's Vineyard, at the command of the Martha's Vineyard, were two of the most fundamental Manhattan Project physicists. Basically, J. Robert Oppenheimer and Edward Teller. And so the entire story of the Philadelphia experiment that was passed down to us through books and TV shows and a feature film and so forth was a cover story to essentially conceal the fact that the very physicists who designed the atomic bomb were working on teleportation based on Tesla's technology. Left at his death on what, January 7th, 1943. So the Philadelphia experiment happened. There was an experiment that resulted in a catastrophe when the ship was essentially giving off such electrostatic energy that, you know, one of the sailors was killed. Now, the ship didn't go back to Norfolk, Virginia. It went back to Newport News, Virginia, and so forth. So that is part of Tesla's legacy. They experimented with it after his death, shortly after his death. It was like in 1944, I believe, or even 43. Maybe it was August of 43. So it's about, 6 to 8 months after Tesla's death, right? And yet it was covered up to basically discredit and disinform and de-link the connection between the Manhattan Project physicists in Los Alamos, Tesla, and teleportation. Because that was one of the technologies they were hoping to both deal with the ET situation and their Cold War vis-a-vis the former Soviet Union. So that kind of came down to us as a form of disinformation to really conceal the critical linkage between Tesla, the Los Alamos physicists, and a functional form of of teleportation that they were experimenting with even during World War II.
So this Tesseract that was based on Tesla's technology, was that something that incorporated the famous Tesla coil that I guess most people have heard about as some kind of transformer for generating very high electrostatic charges, that the Tesseract kind of took that to another level?
It might have. I can say that in the classic things we see of Tesla's work of that kind, there wasn't anything of that kind in the teleporter that I had contact with at Curtis Wright in Woodridge, New Jersey, and then at the Sandia National Labs near Kirtland Air Force Base northeast of Albuquerque, New Mexico. That was the device we would get back home with. It was basically those two booms and that field of energy being propagated. I do remember, and this may be germane to the search for the truth in the National Archive, as it were, that it wasn't identified as a Tesla energetic array. It was just identified by Tesla as energetic array. And then in the sort of on the shop level of my dad's kind of work, you know, Dr. Agnew's work and so forth, they began calling it a Tesla energetic array. So that when I found the phrase Tesseract in Madeline L'Engle's book, A Wrinkle in Time, I said, Dad, look at these things that are from our project. Tesseract, CW is Curtis Wright. The kids leave on a white Pegasus at the end of the novel. And my dad said, oh, yeah, that's disinformation. Now, I think when I dated L'Engle's book, it was like 1962. So I think that the disinformation on Pegasus was probably being scripted by no later than, let's say, the late 1950s. But I don't think that what we saw of Tesla's sort of electrical engineering experiments, like the Wardenclyffe Tower and so forth, I think that's part of Tesla's career. But I think that may have even been architected to conceal these other devices that were sort of kept classified in the inner sanctum of the defense technical community.
So your father starts working for the Ralph M. Parsons Company in the 60s, and that creates the breakthroughs in teleportation and eventually time travel. So, you know, who was Ralph Parsons and how did he bring about this breakthrough that led to Pegasus making him a multimillionaire?
Right. Ralph M. Parsons, who was a lifelong bachelor, kind of a strange cat. I met him one time. I actually stayed in his office. But Parsons had been an assistant to Stephen Bechtel when Bechtel took, $100,000 and made about a $50 million fortune founding the Bechtel Engineering Company, building Liberty ships for the U.S. Navy during World War II. The other assistant to Stephen Bechtel was John Alexander McCone, who would go on to be the director of the Central Intelligence Agency from 1960 to 1964, the very CIA director when President Kennedy was assassinated. So Parsons left Bechtel and founded the Ralph M. Parsons Company. My father was hired initially by the Parsons-Jerden Corporation, which had a single contract. It was sort of like a copper smelting contract for Anaconda Copper, which necessitated a lot of trips to Chile by my dad. But then in 1966 or so, he joined the Ralph M. Parsons Company with its offices on Wall Street in New York City, later to move to a 6-acre campus on West Walnut Street in Pasadena, California, which I think they just moved them. I think they're now in Virginia. But Parsons would evolve after the initial sort of start of his career that Parsons got with Bechtel. Parsons would sort of vie with Bechtel to be the leading process engineering company in the world. I know that the Ralph M. Parsons Company was the engineering company that did the most to further Tesla's work on things like this energetic array and other advanced applications in quantum physics for a number of reasons. Not only my father's work, but the fact that one of his principal, one of the Project Pegasus principals that I was having contact with in New Mexico, for example, was Joseph Connison of Parsons. And I called Joe Connison around 2000. He was about 90 years old. And he affirmed the existence of the teleporters and the chronovisors. And he said, you know, when I told him I was going to write a book and try to have a movie made about my experiences, he said, a book, a movie, nobody on the outside knows about that stuff. So I've often commented, you know, when people just drive past Parsons there at, you know, as they enter Pasadena from the west and look over at that immaculate campus they had there for many years, those three big buildings, one wouldn't think, oh, that's where time travel was pioneered, but that in fact was the location where they were still working on time travel after I left the project in 1972, when Parsons moved to that complex there in Pasadena. So in addition, I was at the christening of the world's largest private yacht that Ralph M. Parsons bought from the Iranian arms merchant Adnan Khashoggi in 1972. Parsons would, I think, pass away in 1974. That christening was in Long Beach Harbor, and there were many people from Project Pegasus on it, in addition to other important individuals at, you know, had built Parsons and made Ralph M. Parsons a billionaire. Now, what's conspicuous about that, and this was on the Parsons website, you know, after the internet emerged in like 1995, that ship had sort of a Farsi or Iranian or Persian name when it was owned by Adnan Khashoggi. I don't recall what it was, but Parsons purchased that largest private yacht in the world from Khashoggi and renamed it Pegasus II. So that christening of that ship in Long Beach was kind of a celebration of the fact that Pegasus had made Ralph M. Parsons a billionaire many times over. And there's no question that Parsons was the principal company in the derivation of time travel.
And I think that's something that can be confirmed by the public records. I know when I started to explore your case, I found the newspaper clipping that showed Ralph Parsons purchasing a yacht called the Pegasus II. And so that does establish a link between Parsons becoming fabulously, fabulously wealthy and this Pegasus project. So that really was empirical evidence that did support your claims. So one of the things about this work that the Parsons Company is doing on teleportation, and so that morphs into time travel. So can you explain how, because you have teleportation by 67 is fully functional, you're involved in it, your father's involved in it, and time travel is more or less just becoming a functional program. So it seemed that first the military intelligence community worked on and developed teleportation as a functional program, and then time travel starts to be developed as a kind of like follow-on or corollary to that. So can you maybe explain that, how that happened, teleportation, time travel, and the experiments?
Right. Initially, and I'm sure of this, when we first started teleporting there in like 67, 68, I'm in my book, Once Upon a Time in the Time Stream, I'm dating it at winter or the early months of 1968, but that may be too late. It could have been earlier. I just don't know. It's been over 50 years and I do not have written record. In fact, I was instructed by my dad to not leave any written records. In 1972, when we moved to California from New Jersey, I actually started writing everything down, and he ripped it up and flushed it down the commode. He did not want me keeping any written records. So it was at least by the winter of 68. I know that initially it was teleportation in real time, so that if I, you know, checked a clock when I got to New Mexico, it was earlier in the day, being, you know, a few hours behind New Jersey. But I know that by 1970, they had essentially done something internally with the teleporter to set it for a time before or after we had jumped through the device at Curtis Wright. Now, the danger of that with teleportation was that it couldn't be before the advent of teleportation, or we would be stranded, for example, in the past. If there was no teleporter to jump home from the past, we would be stranded there. And that wasn't a verity of science or technology. That was just a practical fact. There was no mystical reason for that. It was just the inability to get home, just like if your ship sank at sea and you didn't have a way to get off an island or something. So we would have been stuck there. So initially they were very short hops, but certainly by summer of 70, my father and I jumped through the device, stayed in New Mexico for several months, and then jumped home so as to arrive about 15 minutes after we had originally teleported from New Jersey at the beginning of the summer. And in that way, I experienced what I call my hidden summers in New Mexico. They were the summers of 1970, 71, summer of 73, accessed through fall of 71, and then summer of 72. And that took years for me to disentangle when I began going back and revisiting my memories of the program. It was so difficult to understand what those, because I remembered, for example, that the time when we jumped through the device in fall of 71, and we went down to Old Town Albuquerque to visit my dad's old friend, Connie Chavez, who was sort of a waitress and a cashier for the La Hacienda and La Placita restaurants in Old Town Albuquerque. And my dad said, Andy, come over here and tell Connie what year it is. And I said, what year it is? Well, Connie, it's 1971. And she actually fell off her chair when I said that, because on her timeline, it was 1973. So that was the way in which Project Pegasus was effectuating what I call quantum displacement. They were literally beginning to move both distinguished engineers and physicists like my father, and also I know CIA personnel around in time space. Now, the value of that, for example, was, look, when we were teleporting to New Mexico in fall of 71 to arrive in summer of 73, we were hearing about the events of that time. Like, I remember going past these two CIA guys at a bar. My father had pointed them out. I heard them say, so it looks like Nixon gets entangled in a scandal called Watergate and resigns the presidency. So I know that they were essentially moving us around within the ambit of several years forward and backward in that way to get information of future events and then sort of slipstream that information back to the government. Now, my dad was not an intelligence agent per se, although he always had reporting requirements to all branches of the service and all of the intel agencies, including the CIA. But I do remember different things from the future that they were discerning that were going into the intelligence reports that sort of wise guys from the CIA, like John Alexander McCone, were kind of following. They were sort of staying on top of the information about future events that were being collected by the program. And I remember hearing about the internet. I remember hearing about AIDS as a communicative disease. I remember meeting both George H.W. Bush and George W. Bush and Bill Clinton right after they were apprised of their future presidencies, as well as Richard Cheney, the future vice president. I mean, I met Cheney on the project when he was a 29-year-old. So I know that future American leaders were being apprised of their destiny as president and vice president. The computer revolution and 9/11. 9/11 was discussed right in front of me several times, as I truthfully stated in my affidavit before the Vancouver 911 tribunal. My dad would even describe the building that was built after the Twin Towers were completely destroyed, the new Freedom Tower, whatever it's called. So they were basically using time travel, not so much to just time travel, but to gather information about future events and even past events, to engage in sort of better contingency planning for present and future events. But I must note that if you look at the way that time travel to the past works and the future, you can't change the past or future. You can only fulfill it. Because, for example, when you move to the past and engage in what I call retrocausation, you are in the past. So you're creating the original past. You can't change the original past by going to it. And likewise with the future. They were prizing future American leaders to sort of psychologically adjust to their destinies. but not to literally engage in quantum engineering. And I would add that when Dr. Robert Beckwith, who was really a brilliant, you know, physicist and engineer and inventor, he had about 20 patents that were bought up by Robert Noyce to build Intel Corporation, right? He was really one of the forefathers of the computer age. Whenever Beckwith would, you know, wax eloquent about the quantum engineering that Project Pegasus could ultimately get involved in, you know, explaining to me as a 9-year-old that that's why my dad's engineering company, Parsons, was on the project, everybody at the table at lunch would just roll their eyes. They clearly had a widespread bias against quantum engineering. And that makes perfect sense, because to the extent that it was an intelligence gathering program, if you began trying to find things out about the future and then manipulate things in the present to change those events or improve them or prevent negative events in the future, you would vitiate the very quality of the intelligence you were collecting. And you would alter the timelines to the point where your time travel wouldn't be valuable.
So from 69 to 72, you're working on Project Pegasus as a preteen, and you are hearing all of these discussions, all of these people, of some of them future presidents or future secretaries of defense and so forth, talking about what they had learned through this time travel technology. And they were using this teleporter as a means of being able to take people into the future to kind of like spy or get information about these future events and then bring that back.
And conditions, yes.
But that period, or 67, 68, that is the kind of baseline, because as you said, you couldn't go further back using the teleporter, because there was no teleporter then in operation. So the baseline was always when the teleporter began being used, and that way anyone returning back to that baseline or that year could somehow adjust the time aspect of the teleporter to kind of move forward to whatever time they originally departed from. Is that kind of like the way it worked?
Well, I think that the way to conceive of what happened is that by 1970, they had teleportation-based time travel, in the sense that they could adjust the teleporter so you would arrive a few months or years in the past or future. But they knew they couldn't push it before then, because at least teleportation had to exist, right? The devices had to be there in New Mexico to get us home. But then through 70, 71, 72, they were clearly moving around within an ambit of several years. Because, for example, we made that jump from fall of 71 to the beginning of the summer of 73 in New Mexico, and stayed in White Rock, New Mexico. That was the house at 20 Grand Canyon that I took Governor Ventura to on conspiracy theory. And I tried to explain that to the woman living there, that I had lived there first in 1973, and then in 1972, and that was a true story, because we had been quantum displaced from 71 to 73, and then in real time had teleported and stayed there in summer of 72. And there were all kinds of weird madcap kind of disconnects with Connie Chavez, because when we met with her, we would remember things that had happened and that we'd discussed with her in 73 that from her perspective in 72 hadn't happened yet. So there were some interesting sociological experiments going on. I was very upset when my dad told me we were going to spend the whole summer there. And I had actually spent several summers earlier than that, but they were sort of in a period of my childhood where they had kind of faded from memory. So there in summer of 73, as accessed from fall of 71 when I was 10, I became quite upset about the fact that we're going to be spending the whole summer there. And I was worried that primarily that my mother and four older siblings would miss me and wonder what had happened to me, like had I run away from home or something. Because I really started thinking about the significance of these hidden summers in New Mexico. And my dad showed me that at the end of the summer, we were going to loop back so as not only to teleport back to New Jersey, but back in time. So he created kind of a timeline, and they made this grand sort of fishhook-shaped drawing. So see, son, we're not just going to be teleporting back to New Jersey, but so as to arrive, you know, shortly after we originally left. So your mom and your four siblings are not going to worry about what happened to you. We're just going to be coming home from the hardware store. They're not going to know that we were in New Mexico for a whole summer during that trip to the hardware store, as it were. So it was rather bizarre for a child to cope with these sort of dislocations in time. And there were really some, quite frankly, some nightmarish experiences. Like one time, you know, because I was doing a lot of teleporting back to New Jersey by myself and even to New Mexico by myself, or with my dad or with some of the other kids in the program. But one time I teleported home by myself and I took a school bus back to my school, which was Mountview Road School in Morris Plains. And I walked home and I went to our house and I tried to open the front door, and a woman came to the door, and then, you know, I tried to get in and she slammed the door in my face, and then I kept on ringing on the bell and she came to the door again, and another family was living in our house. So I told her what I was doing and she let me live there for about a week. They were quite kind to me and they contacted the government, and my dad later explained that the government contacted him at work and somehow they got me home. But Michael, what this indicates is that by, let's say, 1971, the DARPA and the other intelligence agencies of this country were communicating with alternative realities, with other dimensions. In other words, where there was a 35 Countrywood Drive, Morris Plains, New Jersey, 07950, the house I had been taken to when I was born. But here I am as a 10-year-old going to my house where I'm expecting my family of seven to be living, including myself. And there's another family living there because it's another dimension. Now, I know that whatever that dimension was, it was able to communicate with my home dimension, as it were, because the government contacted my father at work and discussed the fact that they were going to have to get me home. So it's not just a matter of Project Pegasus proving the multiverse. It's a matter of establishing the truth of the fact that DARPA and CIA and so forth were literally communicating between alternative dimensions of our primary reality, as it were.
Now, maybe to get some clarification here, are we talking alternative dimension or alternative world or alternative timeline? Because, you know, you're going to that house with that family living in it, and somehow your father in that alternative dimension or timeline, whatever you want to call it, gets a phone call and knows all about this kind of like time travel experiments and knows that that you are there by mistake, that you actually belong to another dimension. And so, you know, I mean, in that dimension, does he still have like 9 children? Maybe he has 6. I mean, are there differences? I mean, other than not living at the same place. And so, you know, he obviously knew about these time travel experiments in that
dimension. I would call it a timeline or dimension, but it wasn't my father's family living in that house. It was a completely different family. And it was very deracinating, very alienating for me to encounter that. And I kind of sunk into a deep depression because I thought, my God, I'm stuck in another timeline. I explained it to the lady. I said, ma'am, this is my house, but now you're living here. So, and I explained to her how I just teleported from New Mexico. So they must have brought me back in time, but in the wrong space. And she kind of listened to me and then finally contacted the government. And then whoever was brought into it by the government was somehow able to communicate with my dad in my original dimension. So, you know, I've talked about the fact that my dad explained that huge microwave tower array immediately west of the Continental Divide sign north of Pagosa Springs, Colorado. My dad explained that was the microwave tower array that was sort of pinging microwave transmissions out into space to enable the government to sort of hone in on these different dimensions and locate another dimension or communicate with it. So I'm assuming, arguendo, that government officials in that dimension or on that timeline, if you will, use some kind of advanced technology to inform Project Pegasus and my dad that I had been slipstreamed into the wrong dimension when I teleported home that day.
So that means that there are multiple timelines or dimensions where you have a Project Pegasus running and authorities move people back and forth in time or teleport them from one space to another in their particular timeline, but are also aware of other timelines where people might accidentally cross over, and so they need to be relocated, and they somehow are able to do this.
Yes, and that was also revealed when they sent me to Ford's Theater in April of 1865 with the express mission of trying to see who shot President Lincoln. I did end up seeing Lincoln coming into the lobby with Mrs. Lincoln, and I saw him once sitting in his balcony seating, but I did not see who shot him. I later found out that there was a reason for that, and that's because the Lincolns came to Ford Theater late that night. But I described how every time I would, for example, pop into view in front of Ford's Theater, and that was via chronovision, not teleportation. You know, in other words, I would stand on a stage in New Jersey. A hologram of light would be brought down around me by the crystal array in the ceiling, where they were putting an electromagnetic signal through an eight-sided bismuth crystal. And I would immediately go to that time and place that was being holographically rendered in the chronovisor. Every time they put me down in front of Ford's Theater, the street was muddy. It looked the same. But then I would go to the front of the theater where there was a table where you had to give your ticket or pay for a ticket. And there was always a different person doing that. It was like a man, and then a man and his son, and then the son, and then the son and his best friend. In other words, there were always different people manning the table at the front of Ford's Theater. I also remember going into the lobby. One time there was this dandy walking by with these two very pretty women. They looked like maybe even twin sisters. And then another time I went through the lobby, it was just one woman with this dandy walking along. There was one time when I looked to my right and I thought I was seeing myself in a hallway mirror. And then the image on my right went off the mirror and started walking to the right. And I realized, my God, that's not me in a mirror. That is me on a previous jump. So the Project Pegasus essentially not only proved the multiverse, it was working with the multiverse. For example, time travel to the past involving children in chronovision was shut down at this meeting. It was held at the Sandia Auditorium. The director of Project Pegasus, who looked a lot like J. Allen Hynek, I don't know if it was Hynek, but the man certainly looked like him from that era, you know, with the Van Dyke beard and the whole thing. What we're finding is that when we send the same child or another child to the same so-called past event, it changes a little bit. While we're gathering intelligence using this modality of time travel, it's not intelligence that we can rely on. So I'm sorry to announce, I know this is going to disappoint many of you, but we're shutting down time travel to the past involving the children using chronovision. So I visited multiple happenings, as it were, multiple events where they were trying to send me to the day Lincoln was shot in the very place where he was shot on our timeline, but it was sort of hit or miss. There were times when I was visiting a Lincoln assassination site from a slightly different dimension or timeline. And that is the complexity of the multiverse.
I know you also got to go to the Gettysburg Address by Abraham Lincoln. And there's a photograph, a famous photograph that you identified and said, well, that the child in that photograph is me. So was this using, obviously that wasn't the teleporter, and it doesn't sound like, I think you mentioned another type of time travel device, not a chronovisor. So yeah, explain that incident and the technology that was used for that one.
Right. I wasn't set on many, many time travels via the plasma confinement chamber, but that was one of them. It was under the direction of Dr. Sterling Colgate, the president and former dean of physics of the New Mexico Institute of Science and Technology, also known as New Mexico Tech. Dr. Colgate had been involved at both New Mexico Tech and the Aerojet Corporation facility that used to be sort of within the heart of the New Mexico Tech campus, right near its research library, analyzing information gathered from the future via different technologies. So I knew Dr. Colgate before, about spring of 72, when he was back in New Jersey and explained to me that also the adults on the project, like my dad, were teleporting. and he had teleported from New Mexico to New Jersey. And they explained to me that they wanted to give me kind of a treat because I had served ably and well in Project Pegasus and had done everything that I had been asked to do to the best of my ability. And I could see that my dad was quite proud of me and grateful for my performance over the last 3 years or so. And my dad said, "Do you want to go back to Gettysburg and see President Lincoln give the Gettysburg Address?" And I kind of froze up because I was remembering that 1863 image of Lincoln by Alexander Gardner where he's sort of looking straight forward. And he looks sort of like a smoldering monkey. You know, there's kind of an otherworldly look to Lincoln in that photograph. And I said, "Oh, Dad, I don't know if I can stand in front of the dais there in Gettysburg and watch Mr. Lincoln give the Gettysburg Address. That might just be too overwhelming." And that's like the most famous speech in presidential history, in the history of our country. And then Dr. Colgate piped in, "Well, Ray, let's reconvene in several weeks and we'll ask Andy the same question." And they did. And by then I had kind of gotten the courage to confront going to Gettysburg and seeing Lincoln. And I was placed in the care of this woman named Valerie, who dressed me as a Union bugle boy and said she wasn't going to give me a trumpet because I played the saxophone, so they wouldn't want me to be quizzed as to where my trumpet was and could I play a tune. And I went, they showed me the plasma confinement chamber. It was like a big lucite chamber. I would say about half the size on the length of a tennis court and maybe about 12 or 14 feet high. So you would go in through a door on the side of this big lucite chamber. And it was explained to me that when we walked into the sort of opalescent plasma that was swirling at the end of the chamber, I would feel kind of a trap door effect and sort of cascade through the bottom and then go through about 30 minutes of wormholing. Now, this was actual wormholing going all over the place, like as depicted in What the Bleep Do We Know. The Tesla teleporter was just kind of a straight shot within sort of a oblate triangular circle of light. But this wormholing was quite violent. And my hat was ripped off, both of my shoes, one of my socks. And then I was just sort of spit out in the farmland north of Gettysburg on November 19th of 1863. And as my dad had instructed me, I got rid of anything that was conspicuous. So I got rid of the other sock and just threw it in the bushes. And then I started walking arbitrarily in one direction on that road. And I yelled to a Union soldier, rather young soldier, like 18 or 19 years old. As my dad had instructed me, I yelled, "Hey friend, which way Gettysburg?" And this soldier stopped and pointed directly in the direction I was walking, and I walked right into Gettysburg. And when I got there, downtown Gettysburg was not what I had expected. It wasn't any, I mean, I was growing up near New York City, you know, New Jersey, and I had been to other major cities. And when I got into downtown Gettysburg, I didn't even realize it was a downtown. It had like wooden sidewalks that accommodated about maybe three of the storefronts, and then there'd be a break. And then three more stores would have a wooden sidewalk, you know. So I walked in and I was just looking through a shop window because I was shivering with cold. It was extremely cold. And some of my clothing had been ripped off and I didn't have a jacket to begin with. I just had the sort of navy blue uniform of a Union bugle boy. And when I did so, and I was looking through a millinery shop there, a man that I've later identified as John Lawrence Burns, one of the heroes of Gettysburg, ambled up onto the sidewalk with kind of favoring a wound in his leg. He was kind of hobbling and said, boy, what are you doing out here without a hat, without a jacket? You're going to catch your grip, son. Let me take you in the shop here and get you a hat, get you a coat, get you some shoes. And Burns took me in and outfitted me. And then quickly walked out of the store saying, "Well, young man, the President of the United States is going to be here today, and I've got a speech to go to." And I kind of followed Burns all the way from that millinery shop, which I've identified as being owned by David Kendall Hart and his wife, Eliza Ann Bowen, hence also known as David Bowen. He was town council president, lawyer, and shoemaker. John Lawrence Burns was constable of Gettysburg and a cobbler. And I know that Mrs. Kendall Hart, Eliza Ann Bowen, came in and must have scolded John Lawrence Burns about giving away the jacket that he gave me and the shoes and so forth, because I found out that the Kendall Harts were the leaders of the Underground Railroad station in Gettysburg. So when Mrs. Kendall Hart came in the store as Burns was outfitting me with those clothes, she must have been saying something like, "John, I don't want you giving our jackets away to any wayfaring, Union bugle boy who hobbles into town, shell-shocked from the war," whatever term they used then, "because these are for our escaped slaves." There was like a pile of jackets in the back room of the millinery shop. But they owned that millinery shop, and I was able to identify Eliza Ann Bowen by picture as the woman who came into the store. But when she did come into the store, there was kind of a time travel effect where everything was speeding up and slowing down. So I didn't really see what she and Mr. Burns said to each other. But he then did finish the task of equipping me with adequate clothing. And then I followed him on that diagonal down to, Baltimore Street over the Evergreen Cemetery to the site of the Gettysburg Address. Now, there were people gathering there that when there was about maybe, there were a few people there when I walked over there. And one of the first people there was my late father. But he didn't look like himself back at the plasma confinement chamber in East Hanover that Dr. Colgate was operating, that he and Dr. Colgate were operating. He looked like a younger version of my dad. He was heavier. He had a crew cut, as he did in the mid-60s. And I later found out from my dad, he said, "That's how I found out that you, son, were going to be in the program." But I had gone years earlier. So that was an earlier version of my dad from my perspective. As a 10-year-old, it was like my dad when I was a 5-year-old. So he had gone from that plasma confinement chamber in East Hanover to Gettysburg on November 19th of 1863, but at an earlier time, literally years earlier in real time. And then he thought, "My God, here's my 5-year-old son sitting here, standing here next to me as a 10-year-old dressed as a Union bugle boy." And so because he knew it was sort of a threat to operational security that we were recognizing each other as father and son at Gettysburg, literally on the day that Lincoln was going to be arriving there, he said, he kind of backed away from me and said, "I'm not your paw boy." And after I was kind of quizzed by two Union officers, because I had been trained to avoid being detected that I was a time traveler, I walked about 100 paces from the dais, kind of giving up the opportunity to see Lincoln give the Gettysburg Address. And I stood with my back literally to the dais, and I kind of put my left foot forward and my right foot to the right, standing in kind of this 1970s kind of pose, because I was trying to disguise the shoes that I had been outfitted in. I knew they were not my shoes. And there were some gentlemen standing over to my left. And as I did so, I saw this man who looked like the Civil War photographer Matthew Brady. It may have been an assistant to Brady named Bacharach, George Bacharach. And as I was fading from view and the plasma confinement effect was wearing off, he took the picture. And that was one of only 5% of Civil War photographs to survive after all those glass panes were used in greenhouses after the war and they faded in the sun. But with that picture, the so-called Josephine Cobb image of Lincoln at Gettysburg survives. It was just identified as containing that tiny little pixels of Lincoln in the back of the image. Today, the original of that photograph is at the National Archives, and it's classified. Now, why would that be? Sure, it's only one of 5% of Civil War photographs to the extent, but I believe it's because it captures the first image of a time traveler from the future, and I was that time traveler. So while I lost the opportunity to see Lincoln give his famous Gettysburg Address, by moving away from the dais and being photographed by either Brady or one of his principal assistants, we have photographic evidence of my presence in the past. Literally, 98 years before I was born in 1961. Now, John Gannon and William B. Stillings, one of my fellow Mars astronauts, analyzed that photograph. And they found that my eye socket and my cheekbone are visible when you look at that boy's face. And that's consistent with what I said, the fact that I was fading from view when Brady or his assistant took that photograph. But that is me. I identified as myself when it was published in a news magazine, and I showed one of my sisters, and I took it to my dad and said, look, Dad, when you sent me to Gettysburg, they got a picture of me. And he looked at it and he said, yep, just don't tell anybody. So the image is, I believe, the first image of a time traveler from the future, literally confirmed as such by somebody operating in a need-to-know position on the time-space program. And that was my father.
So this plasma confinement chamber that uses some kind of wormholing principle to transfer you from A to B, I mean, that isn't limited like the teleporter in terms of you cannot go further back than the time the teleporter was invented, that this plasma confinement chamber can take you back way back in time, and it uses the principle of wormhole. So is that similar?
Right. It didn't require a machine. It didn't require a time travel device to get home, because the effect that it induced would just wear off and you'd have kind of like this Kundalini sensation, and then boom, you were back in the chamber in the present.
Yeah, well, that kind
just
of
like
reminds me.
Yeah.
That reminds me of the show Time Tunnel that aired in 1967. It seemed to be a very similar principle to that, where you would kind of like go through this time tunnel, and it appeared to be kind of like a wormhole, and you end up there, and then after a certain time you kind of vanish, and then you're taken, you know, either back or somewhere else. That series, Time Tunnel, I think it was probably created as a kind of like hiding the truth in plain sight, you know, soft disclosure.
I agree wholeheartedly with that surmise, Michael. And I think that Time Tunnel was probably a concretization, literally, of the Tesla teleporter after it became a time machine. I think that the plasma confinement and chronovision and these other technologies that were more rays of time travel rather than lines, in the sense that they could send you somewhere and then you would just pop back into view, might be more consistent with a TV show like Sliders. But I do think that these were disinformational. And my dad confirmed, as I mentioned, the disinformational thrust of Engels' novel, A Wrinkle in Time. Now, one thing that I'm certainly concerned about when I look at my health today at age 60, where I'm now blind and in kidney failure, is the fact that I know that the plasma confinement chamber was exposing me to radiation. Now, there were three types of sort of advanced medical or drugging that I was getting. My dad was giving me shots of vanadium in the left leg down in our basement. And I said, Dad, why are you giving me these shots? And this was through the whole, my third, fourth, and fifth grade year when I was time traveling in Pegasus. And he said, to protect your teeth and bones from radiation. Then I was getting shots of gamma globulin in the left arm at the Morristown Army Arsenal. And when I asked the registered nurse who would always be administering those, why am I getting these? She said, to make you super smart. And then my dad was dropping me off at Allied Chemical in Parsippany, New Jersey, where I was getting like these 30-minute bursts of gamma radiation. There was like this gamma machine that I would sit in front of, and it would go make this kind of snapping sound, and I was being hit with gamma radiation. And I said, Dad, why are you dropping me off here all the time? And he said, to lighten your light body for the teleportation. So I don't really like to depict myself as a guinea pig, because I was really one of America's early time-space explorers. But there were medical consequences that were literally being placed into effect by DARPA. I don't like to say I was a lab rat or a guinea pig, but I was being sort of medically handled in ways to cope with the effects I was being exposed to. So, for example, in those hidden summers in New Mexico, my dad was giving me some kind of medication. It was a big pill, almost about the size of a big piece of a chewing gum, you know, a big sphere of bubble gum that I had to swallow. And to this day, I can swallow anything. And I said, Dad, why do I have to take these pills? And he said, to counter the effects of the teleportation. Now, by 2003, what, 31 years after I left the program, I met with Jack Pruitt and his son Glenn at the old Sweeney Auditorium in Santa Fe, New Mexico. And Jack said that all of the children in Pegasus were getting a disease that mimicked diabetes, and all the adults had gotten heart valve defect. In fact, my dad had a St. Jude's cuff in his mitral valve that prolonged his life for 13 years, you know, with that device clicking away in his chest cavity to make his heart function properly. So that was really the medical downside of Pegasus. The children developed a disease that mimicked diabetes, and the adults had heart valve defects. And that was confirmed for me by Courtney Maurice Hunt of the CIA years later, even after my dad's death in 1990 from heart disease. So I knew from 2003 forward, after my meeting with Jack Pruitt, that I had to do everything I could to control essentially metabolic syndrome. And I was. I mean, if you look at my weight, let's say when I appeared in Argentina in 2014, I was 53 years old, and I was maybe 210, 220 pounds, and I was actually eating a restricted diet. Now, Jack's son Glenn would die in around, 2007 of congestive heart disease and pulmonary edema at like 700 pounds. So one of the reasons I launched my truth campaign about Project Pegasus was to take the information that Jack gave me about this metabolic syndrome, my own experience with it, and then the death of Glenn Pruitt, to take that to my fellow child time travelers, all of them grown up, and because of the good graces of the internet, primarily Facebook, I was able to find quite a number of them. Only one of them remembered teleporting. And I didn't realize when I was talking to him on the phone in around 2004, 2005, that he was the boy who had lost his feet teleporting to Santa Fe. And then I lost track of him. He kind of shut down and wouldn't let me communicate with him. Many of the other kids remembered the Montauk chair and the yellow book lessons we would get at that SO night school in Convent Station, New Jersey, but were sort of blocked on the more sophisticated things we did off campus. So I kind of had to cope with the fact that rudimentary forms of mind control had been used on that generation of children in special access programs. But I'm really grateful for the two individuals who ultimately came forward and confirmed remembering the teleportation experiences.
Now, you mentioned the yellow book. Is that the famous yellow book of different extraterrestrial races that you were exposed to at that time?
What we were told was it was one book about the origin of our planet and one about the origin of our galaxy that had been authored by an ET that came to pick up the Roswell crash victims. And he was kind of both a guest and sort of a captive of our country until they let him do so and take those bodies home. And they were really sort of lessons in the ET situation. So, for example, a major part of my yellow book lessons was learning the Astarte alphabet. I had been taught maybe 240, 256 symbols in the Astarte alphabet by an itinerant special educator in the Hanover Township School District named Joseph Humer. In my fifth grade year, I was sort of hypnotized with a metronome by an itinerant musical instrument teacher named Harvey Altman. And Mr. Altman walked me across the hall into this meeting with Joe Humer. And Joe Humer, you know, basically gave me this ET briefing about how they knew ETs had been visiting us for several thousand years, contacting and even abducting particular people for several hundred years, that such contactees could expect to be contacted throughout their life cycle, and that I was one of those contactees, which indeed I was from early childhood, primarily the small grades. And he said, Andrew, it's your responsibility to during your life to find out who they are, where they're from, and what they want. Okay, now, interestingly, the reason I'm sharing this anecdote, Michael, is that Harvey Altman became principal of Memorial Middle School, and this other itinerant instructor from the, 1972, Joe Humer, became principal of that very elementary school that I was attending. So that shows, I think, the degree to which the intelligence community had sort of burrowed into academia at the elementary, junior high, and high school level in the United States to sort of track the ET situation. I had been interviewed by the FBI as early as spring of my kindergarten year. Okay, that was spring of 1967. I have the name of one of those FBI agents. He was Richard Bauer Sr. His son, Richard Bauer Jr. of Malibu, California, sent me his picture, and I said, that's the guy that interviewed me about my ET experiences. So I just find it very interesting that those two itinerant teachers of mine from my fourth and fifth grade year would become the very principals of those two schools, that elementary school and then the next junior high school that all those students would go on to in the sixth grade. After Mr. Humer taught me like those several hundred characters in the Astarte alphabet to communicate with the ETs, then my dad and I jumped from fall of 71, which is, of course, the beginning of my fifth grade year, fall of 71 to summer of 73 in New Mexico. And most of what I did that summer was learn more characters of the Astarte alphabet in that lab beneath the auxiliary gym at the Los Alamos Public High School. And one of those teachers was Major Ed Daines, but he was a young Ed Daines. He was like maybe 25 years old. And he was also working with me in the Montauk chair. Now, some of it was sort of time travel related stuff that summer, but a lot of it was just sort of grooming several of the brightest kids on Pegasus as sort of ambassadors to the ET by learning the Astarte alphabet so we'd be able to point to panels of symbols and sort of communicate with them. At least that seems to have been the goal. I never ended up using that alphabet, but my ET contacts sort of dropped off when I was 12 or so, and I had one more when I was 18. And then they ended. So the prediction by Mr. Humer that ET contact would continue throughout my life did not happen. But I think that is part of the ET situation. Mm-hmm. I did find from Courtney Hunt of CIA that the ETs were able to track certain industrial materials home on the clothing of aerospace engineers like my dad, and they were sort of using that tracking to then sort of test and train their children. Now, as is consistent with the findings of Dr. John Mack in his book Abduction, I feel that the primary legacy of all those ET contacts was to kind of give me sort of a planetarian consciousness. I mean, I would go on to write for the Cousteau Society, and under the direction of Jean-Michel Cousteau, and then get a JD and a certificate in environmental natural resources law from Lewis and Clark, the world's largest and oldest environmental law program, and then get two master's degrees in environmental affairs at Cal Poly San Luis Obispo and at the University of Cambridge. So I just took the study of the environment and how to rescue it, how to make it the central organizing principle of civilization, as Al Gore stated in his book, Earth in the Balance. I made that my life and attribute those ET contacts to that sort of purpose in life.
Mm-hmm. Well, just coming back to the whole time travel theme now, you mentioned the Montauk chair, and most people are familiar with the Montauk program that ran out of that area in Montauk Point and Long Island from 1970 up to 1983. And they talked about a Montauk chair. So that was based on an extraterrestrial pilot seat that they used for teleportation right. And time travel. So are we talking about the same facility, or are we talking about another Montauk chair that was housed there in New Jersey at that facility that you were working out of?
Well, actually, the chair was never called the Montauk chair when I was placed in it. It was set up wherever they wanted to set it up, but the place primarily they were setting up was the art lab at Mountview, my elementary school, where we were being trained in with that sort of speed learning program called Galileo, where they were giving us this speed learning in the history of science and society since like the year 1450, the time of the high Renaissance. And this individual named David, I don't know if it was a young Dr. David Lewis Anderson, but it might have been. But this young sort of postdoc named David would set up the chair, and we were trained to sit in it. And there was that sort of cathode ray tube coming up from our legs, pointed at our face. And then there was sort of almost like a photographer's umbrella above the seat. And there were two different chairs. There was one that sort of looked like orange Naga hide, and one a later year that looked sort of like a knit black and white and gold and you know, knit fabric. And what would happen in that chair, which I'm certain was the Montauk chair, was you would kind of black out and you would experience a dropping sensation. And then you would experience going up a foot or so. And then you would start moving forward foot first through what I call the quantum plenum. We would hit sort of this plane of almost like black glass, and we would see some image on the horizon, and then we would collide with that image. And we were literally in a subjective moment in our future. I remember, for example, one time coming back from that room to my main classroom at the school with a child named David, not the man running those experiments, a young David, a peer of mine in the program. And he said to me, "So who were you this time?" And I said, "I was a lawyer in Seattle." Okay. So now, Michael, at that time, I had one uncle. My uncle Edward was living in Santa Barbara, California. I had been to the West Coast in the sense that I had, you know, teleported to New Mexico and one time to that Army base up in Washington State. The name has been escaping me. The one south of Seattle there. So I had been to Washington, but the notion that I would one day be a lawyer in Washington State, which indeed I am, I'm now a member of the Washington State Bar Association and the U.S. District Court for the Western District of Washington. But the notion that I would have knowledge as a child that my destiny was to be a lawyer in Washington shows the reach that they had with the Montauk chair. What we were told about the Montauk chair was that it was a pilot seat from a downed UFO that the ETs had used for the pilot to know where they were going at these hypersonic speeds. They wouldn't, crash or have their ship destroyed by, you know, asteroids and other objects in space junk. So they had him literally looking beyond the ambit of their forward progress in their ship. And then we found a way to sort of adapt that pilot seat from a downed UFO into essentially a way to enhance psychic performance. And I asked the young man, the postdoc, David, how is this working? How could we be visiting our future? The chair's not going anywhere. And he said, "Well, Andy, we have two theories. One is either it's changing us because everything's in our mind at birth, and the chair is helping us access that data inside our own consciousness, or it's somehow affecting the environment outside of us." And he said, "Quite frankly, we don't know. All we know is we're getting very reliable information with it." And I mean, I came up with things like the name, the ethnicity, the appearance of one of my sister-in-laws that my brother wouldn't meet until like 1977 in college in California. And things like that. In other words, I was constantly visiting subjective moments in my own future. And that's why I challenge Al Bielek's statement that they were using the Montauk chair to go to Mars. Because in my view, having done both, the only way you could have used the Montauk chair to quote unquote go to Mars was if you saw a subjective moment in your own future when you were going there in the way that we were going to Mars, which was the aeronautical repositioning chamber or arc or jump room or space elevator. So I do know that there were numerous moments of the future that I've lived and will be living that I saw beforehand. Now, my beloved Gwen was featured in one where she had kind of not just dark hair, but kind of bluish. And today, this is amazing, the synchronicity of this, Michael. Today, Gwen has gone to get a new hairstyle where it'll be a beautiful black with kind of a blue sheen. But I saw that in the Montauk chair, that was my the love of my life and my beloved, who I had partnered with, you know, later in my life. So people like that throughout my life, even yourself possibly, I was shown before I met them. It was sort of like proto-meeting of the spirits I would meet in this life. When I was a student at Cambridge in 1995, you may remember I did have that dream of you, and it looked exactly like you, and you were identified as Dr. Michael Sala in the dream. So I think a lot of that, those different types of consciousness that I've had were pretty much triggered by things like the exposure to the Montauk chair in childhood.
Well, I think what we should do is bring this part of the interview to a close, just to wrap it up for people. So I just wanted to finish up part one. by just asking you, in terms of finishing your involvement in this Pegasus program in 1972, you were asked to take a trip, or you did several trips to the year 2045. So what did you see there, and what happened afterwards that led to you finishing your involvement with the Pegasus project?
We were always told what our mission was. Now, the trip to 2045 was achieved via a device called a Stargate. That Stargate was set up in the Olympic-sized basketball court at the Surreals Cultural Center, just as the chronovisor they were using to send me to Ford's Theater in summer of 71, so as to arrive in, 1865, was on the symphony orchestra stage at the back of the Surreals Cultural Center. Now, the Stargate, we would run up on a ramp and go through another gate, very much like the two elliptical booms back at Curtis Wright. It was essentially, the Stargate was an elaborate teleporter. Now, why did it have to be so large? It could literally run up a ramp and then through the gate. That's because we were going 75 years into the future, to the year 2045. And we had to learn how to just sort of get a big gulp of air and then just sort of sip the air off the top of our lungs. Now, I was able to do that fairly easily because I was a saxophone player and had developed, my breathing as it was. But we spent time doing that and being propelled in catapults and stuff to get used to just that sensation of being sort of shot into the future. When we would arrive there, there was sort of a beautiful tungsten steel building with beautiful emerald glass. We'd walk across this plaza, anywhere from being right in front of it to maybe even a mile away from it. We'd have to walk towards it. When we did, we'd go inside, and I remember there were houseplants all over the building. And we were there essentially to get a microfilmed summaries of events that had been recorded between, 1972 and 2045. So in other words, imagine if a historian for the CIA or DARPA was photographing every edition of Time magazine's Year in Review. That's what was kind of described to me. But Jack Pruitt had shown us the microfilm, and it was just foot after foot after foot of all these abstract bars and numbers. In other words, it was all encrypted. We were taking those microfilm summaries in these little canisters. We were placing them where the sun doesn't shine because they didn't want us holding them in our hands because they might be lost in time space. So we would go into the restroom and place them in our bodily cavity with a string attached. And then we would be taken to a room in that building that was just a conference room. And they explained to us that if we just ran really hard against the wall, that wall was a teleporter. And I can tell you that was difficult to practice because it was kind of like, imagine you're 10 years old and you're being trained to literally run into a wall, maybe smack yourself unconscious, right? So we were just trained to run against that wall. And when we did, we entered a Vortal tunnel again. And it was about another 30-minute trip back to the grounds of that Lobo Overlook site immediately west of the Continental Divide site in southwest Colorado. And from there, we would then be driven back to Los Alamos, Santa Fe, Albuquerque, or wherever they wanted us to go in the program. But that was eventually, what my dad had described about the fact that that microwave tower array there was to sort of ping microwave out into space so that the program in 2045 could even find us back in 1972. And that shows the degree of fidelity they had with time travel by the early 1970s. I'm still amazed that by virtue of plasma confinement, they were able to not just to send me to Gettysburg in the past, but literally the day, the morning in which Lincoln would soon be arriving to deliver the Gettysburg Address. But they were doing it. And we were going forward to 2045 to get these sort of the history of the future for the Department of Defense. And who was defense attaché to Project Pegasus when this was going on? The American who, under Presidents Ford and George W. Bush, would spend the greatest number of days as Defense Secretary of the United States, and that was Donald Henry Rumsfeld. I had significant interaction with Rumsfeld. In fact, the guys on the program called him Rummy, and I once called him Rummy, just talking to him, and he said, call me Don, Andy. I don't want the kids on the program calling me Rummy. I don't want them to get in trouble with alcohol use. You know, he's a fairly ethical guy, and he was, I mean, I went into a bar with my dad one time when my dad offered to buy Rummy a drink, and he said, no, as long as I have my martini, I'm fine. And my dad said, as we kind of settled in there, I with my grape knee-high, which I would always be served when we went into a bar anywhere, he said, you know, Rummy, we know in the program that you make defense secretary. And he said, I know that, Ray. I saw that in one of the reports, but that's one future event I'll only believe when it happens. So I do know that the American to serve the greatest number of elapsed days as defense secretary, Donald Rumsfeld, did have prior knowledge of his destiny as Secretary of Defense. And they and he was the defense secretary when 9/11 happened. And I don't remember Rumsfeld discussing 9/11 in front of me, but my dad and his colleagues did several times. And my dad explained exactly what happened on 9/11. So the import of the U.S. mastery of time travel in the early 70s is it allows us to contextualize the events of 9/11. They were events that the U.S. government had prior knowledge of.
Well, what I'd like to do in kind of like bringing this to a close is to just emphasize that, you know, people that are maybe listening to this for the first time, they maybe have questions as to how could any of this be real. One of the things that really impressed me was an interview you did with Art Bell in 2015, where you actually pinpointed him as working at the same IT&T facility in Nutley, New Jersey, that was conducting these time travel experiments, and that you actually said that you went there, you and a group of kids, and that one of the young engineers or technicians working at that IT&T facility was Art Bell. And Art Bell was shocked when you said that during the interview, because no one knew that he was working at IT&T. And he said that it was an actual, you know, top secret project for NATO, and he wasn't kind of like spilling too much about that project. But that impressed me, that the kind of things that you say you were involved in, that there was independent confirmation that you were having access as a youngster. In 1970, you were, what, 9 years old, that you actually were taken to this top secret facility at run by IT&T, which is really one of the top aerospace companies running all sorts of exotic programs. So that was very impressive to me, and, you know, did tell me that yours was a story that was worth pursuing.
Well, I feel very lucky to have been interviewed by Art, because I think he was sort of the best in this genre of radio, and quite a gentleman and a scholar of time travel. And what had happened was that before each major sort of activity in the program, when we had a new experience time traveling, a new device or a new mission, we would be taken on sort of an acclimation trip. Now, what was scheduled for November 5th of 1971, which was the first attempt to chronovise individuals to the future, and not teleport, but chronovise. And we had been taken up to ITT Defense, where that activity would occur, a couple weeks earlier in October. And I and about three other students and our special educator, Elaine Gallagher, she didn't, but the We children sort of ran in to that vast auditorium in a rather noisy manner. And we were trained to be, you know, well-behaved kids, and we were, but this was an exception. And we kind of ran up on this man who was sitting at a table kind of stabilizing one of the chronovisor images. Now, Art said that he was working for that communications program for NATO. Maybe he was memory wiped regarding doing the chronovisor stuff there. But I believe he was attached to Project Pegasus. He was, at least, as you say, doing a very advanced defense work there at that top secret lab. And I described what he was wearing, the fact that he was working there, and what he said to Lane Gallagher, which is when he sort of cursed at us saying, I don't want to repeat what he said, she threatened to take him up on report And Art, being a ladies' man during those years, sort of girlfriended her by saying, well, my name is Arthur William Bell III, but to you, you can call me Art. He sort of flirted with her. And I described how pretty Elaine Gallagher was. I think she looked sort of like a, you know, Diana Rigg at 25 years of age. She was a beautiful young woman. And Art knew that that was consistent with his personality and character in those years, that he was quite a ladies' man. And I described, you know, his shirt with the plastic pen holder in it and the whole thing. And he talked about how he was living with his dad in Newark and working there at ITT Defense. Now, Art had never talked about that. And I literally described what I found him doing, what he was wearing, and the mannerisms by which he treated our very pretty special educator for the school district, Elaine Gallagher. So I think what was so revelatory about that so-called quantum bombshell interview of me by the late Art Bell is that it really confirmed the truth, again, the truth of what I've been saying. It was a real meeting with Art. And, you know, this kind of goes to the indeterminacy of reality. I listened to Art for years, not realizing that he was that young man I met back at ITT Defense. So there's many kind of fractals and foreshadowings in life. You know, Gwen and I met in 1972 in Santa Fe, and now 50 years later, we're engaged to be married. So life is, it's more mysterious than we've imagined. I think that, you know, Stanislav Grof's concept of the self-organizing universe is in play in some way. It's almost like a symphony of souls. But yes, that was Art Bell, and he, I believe in that interview, which I have a copy of, that he essentially confirmed that it was him and that I could not have been in that building or met him in that capacity had I not been on a secret U.S. defense project.
Exactly. So that was independent confirmation for some of the material that you were sharing at the time. Well, Andy, I want to bring this interview to a close, which will be hopefully the first part in a number of interviews that we do. And so at this point, is there anywhere you would direct listeners to learn more about you, to learn about Project Pegasus and your current projects?
Well, I'm doing The Quest for Truth, which is always being posted at my time travel site on Facebook, Project Pegasus, the time travel group of Andrew DiBusciago, and also my presidential campaign site, which is now called Andy for America. I'm not running for president. I ran for president in 2016 and got about 25,000 votes. I don't want to take that task on again. It's too difficult. There's 50 states. I may run for the U.S. Senate, but we're also posting those there just so people can enjoy my current discussions of this topic. I'm also, you know, taking questions regularly on The Quest for Truth with my moderator, my friend Aaron Moriarty. And so that's one place individuals can go. I'm still rebuilding my Project Pegasus website. It's going to be at projectpegasus.info. It was at projectpegasus.com and .net, and then those sites got stolen. But I'm really just focusing on editing my books. I've written 300 chapters about my time travel experiences, 150 chapters about my visits to the Red Planet, as well as a trilogy about my paranormal experiences that have nothing to do with time travel or Mars visitation, and a book about my memories of past lives, because I found that when I lost so much of my vision, not all of it, but a major part of it, and wrote my memoirs of my experiences time traveling and going to Mars for the U.S. government, I kind of had sort of an enlightenment in which both sort of memories, dreams, and reflection of past lives that had been with me my whole life kind of came into sharper focus. So I describe information I came up with, different past lives that I just should not have access to. So my conclusion in my past life book is that they're either proof of the afterlife and the immortality of the soul, which I was told was the case when I was regressed once when I was on Project Pegasus. Because they wanted us to know that our spirits cannot be killed, so that we shouldn't worry about dying and time traveling for the country, because we would just go back to heaven and be live again. Or they were amazing psychic experiences where I've been picking up other people's lives as live. But I mean, I'm talking about very specific words, from even foreign cultures that I've come up with doing the footwork to just get in touch with my past lives. My own personal conviction is that we do not die, but go from life to life on our path to ascension. And I respect anybody else's religious or spiritual beliefs in that area, but I wanted to do a book that basically shows the great progress I made since I was in Project Pegasus to literally revisit my past lives. You know, Gwen and I remember a life together where we've listed 77 things we remember. And neither of us have ever been creative writers. But I've always been a servant of reality. I've always been rather talented as a writer in the area of general interest nonfiction. Okay. So that's the approach I take to these memories of my past life, where you have to ask, if I come up with this rare name that was used in America 200 years ago to describe somebody I met in that lifetime, where could I have come up with that name? So that's kind of the tenor of my afterlife book as well. It's sort of a continuation of that aspect of Pegasus, because Pegasus was not just time travel. They were really training child psychics and really doing everything they could to sort of make us avatars in our generation. You know, I like to say that we were small mediums at large. We started doing remote viewing for the Office of Naval Intelligence. They regressed us to see that our spirits do not die. And then they involved us in various kinds of time travel, various kinds of psychic probes and so forth. And it was really a multimodal kind of program that encompassed time travel of different kinds, physical, holographic, psychic, and so forth. And that, I believe, also includes when we time travel, like when we're dreaming and we have a dream of a past life. It's another form of time travel. It's psychic time travel. Pegasus was involving all of us in that. I don't know why I was selected or the other children. I just think it's because we were bright, psychically gifted children who had been identified by Project Talent, which was that program that Admiral Hyman Rickover started in the late 50s. To identify young Americans of advanced intellectual, psychic, and leadership potential.
I just want to kind of confirm that I actually did follow up on a couple of people that were in that Talented and Gifted Children's program, and they confirmed that you were also part of that. So, well, Andy, I want to thank you profusely for coming on my show, sharing some of your information. You have a really detailed memories of what happened throughout these projects, and I know you have a lot to say also about the Mars jump room, and I hope to talk to you about that in the future, and there's more details about some of these key people you mentioned. So I'm looking forward to our next interview. So thank you.
Yes, well, Michael, let me thank you for the first time publicly about the fact that you first did not believe me, because my work is a tall drink of water, as they say. But it is true, and I really salute you for having the integrity and demonstrating the truth that has to be pursued in the truth movement when you embrace the truth of my experiences following that epochal interview with Art Bell. And I really, I really thank you and salute you for that, demonstrating that adherence to the truth. Because, I think at the end of the day, it's not about me or you or persons. It's not about personalities. It's about the truth itself. And so I think we have to have that kind of flexibility to say, well, I first believed this, but, I've now modified my view of it with this new information. And that is the scientific approach. So I salute you for being scientific in your approach to my material.
Well, thank you, Andy. So all the best, and I look forward to our next conversation.
You have been listening to Exopolitics Today with Dr. Michael Sala. Please remember to like, share, and subscribe to this channel. Join or start a conversation in the comments. Take the time to explore the vast library of best-selling books, webinars, and podcasts by Dr. Sala. Visit exopoliticstoday.com.